Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezra chapter 10. We're going to do verses 1 through 44, the entire chapter. It sounds long, but it's not, because most of the chapter is a list of names of Israelite men who had unfortunately married pagan wives and who had caused Ezra a lot of grief. In our last chapter, chapter 9, we see Ezra going before the temple in the courtyard there, tearing his hair out, ripping his clothes up, and saying, Israel has sinned, and we needed to do something about it. And he prayed to God, and of course the people heard his prayer. So we start now in Ezra 10, verses 1 through 4. Now while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, a very large assembly, men, women, and children, gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, said to Ezra, We have been unfaithful to our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, for this matter is your responsibility. Speaking about Ezra, it's Ezra's responsibility. Shechaniah is speaking to Ezra and said, and he's saying, Ezra, this is your responsibility, but we, the people, will be with you. Be courageous and act. Do something about it. Now, this very large assembly that gathered while Ezra was praying and crying shows that there were still devout Jews in Judah who hadn't liked what was going on with all this marriage with foreign pagan wives. The question arises, why hadn't they spoken up before? Well, a couple of possibilities. Maybe they were afraid. Maybe they did speak up, but were rebuffed. At any rate, the practice had not stopped. It had gone on. Or it could be that there weren't that many people who thought anything about it. They just kind of got hardened to it. And then when they realized that how sinful they were because of Ezra's crying and praying, they might have thought, oh my gosh, he's right. We shouldn't have done it. We shouldn't have tolerated it. We shouldn't have been quiet. And so now we repent. It could be that too. But at any rate, there was a lot of people who were upset. And so Ezra's reform here had the support of the people. Otherwise, I doubt he would have gotten very far. Now, all this bitter crying by this very large assembly of repentant men, women, and children, why were they crying bitterly? Or it's ironic that they were crying bitterly, because percentage-wise, not many of this crowd had married foreign wives. If we look at Ezra 2:64 and read that, it says, The whole combined assembly numbered 42,360. And then in Ezra 8, you have to add the Levites and the Nethinim, the temple servants who came later. So that's, you add another 1,772, and you get a grand total of 44,132 people who were in the land. Now, at the end of this chapter, Ezra 10, we see the names listed of the men who had taken foreign pagan wives. You add them up, and it's 110. I'm relying on commentators. I didn't add it up myself because I don't have that kind of patience. But all these numbers, I'm relying on commentators. And if they're off a little bit, doesn't matter. The point is, you end up with about 0.2% of the people had married foreign wives. And that's interesting, because usually you get the idea that almost everybody in the land had done it, but only a very few had done it. However, it was the leaders of the people who were chiefly guilty of marrying foreign wives. We read in Ezra 9, verse 2, Indeed, the Israelite men have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons. Talking about the pagans' daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed has become mixed with the surrounding peoples. The leaders and officials have taken the lead in this unfaithfulness. The leaders and the officials have taken the lead in this unfaithfulness. So, of course, when leaders do something, it's a lot worse, because people will follow leaders, both for the good and for the evil. So Shechaniah wants to save the day for Ezra. Ezra's just crying. He's not really threatening anything. He's not really saying anything. In fact, when he prayed to God, he just left it open to God. God, here we are. What do? We saw that in the last chapter. And Shechaniah comes to him and says, Look, we can make a covenant and repent of this sin. Now, does that mean that Shechaniah was involved in marrying a foreign wife? Did he have a foreign wife? Well, not necessarily. He might be speaking for the people. His father, however, probably was a guilty party who had married a foreign pagan wife. Shechaniah is the son of Jehiel, it says in verse 2. And then when we look at the list of names of the men who had married foreign wives, well, in verse 26, we see Jehiel listed. Elam's descendants, Mattaniah, Zechariah, Jehiel. So Shechaniah might not have done it himself, but his family was involved. Now in verse 3, Shechaniah advises Ezra to help the people make a covenant with God to put away all the wives and their children. Now this was going to cause bitter division between family and friends, as you can well imagine, so it was gutsy for Shechaniah to call for this. Ezra, in fact, may have thought the whole project would be infeasible but for Shechaniah's exhortation. And of course, it helped that Shechaniah was closer to the people than Ezra. Ezra had just been there 5 months. He didn't know a lot of people yet. He had a decree from Artaxerxes, and he was a big shot in the law. But nonetheless, Shechaniah knew the people better, and so this was a great person to have on Ezra's side. Now, notice it's not just the wives who were to be put away. But in verse 3, we see the children are to be put away, according to Shechaniah's advice. Now, this made the situation even more complicated than it already was. Now, the question is where were the children to be put away? Who's going to get custody of the children, in other words? Well, there's two options. It could be the divorced pagan mothers who would then go back, I suppose, to their pagan fathers, pagan families, and to the surrounding areas, Samaria to the north, maybe to Ammon, a Moab across the Jordan River to the east. Who knows, but maybe they would have just gone and carried their children with them. That's what Gill suggests. Or it could be the divorced Hebrew fathers would get custody, but that's unlikely. You got a pagan child. The pagan child might have been brought up in idolatry, and then the Hebrew father has another kid, and then the older kid influences the younger kid into idolatry. Or maybe the child of the pagan marriage staying with the father, of course, would win the father's heart, and the father would care about that child, and then the mother says, well, let's get back together again so we can parent our child in a proper way, and then the Hebrew father might say, yes, honey, come on back into my house and be the mother of your child. So I think when you look at all that, the children would be sent away with their mothers, plus it's more natural to let little kids go with their mothers. So we can assume that this is what is being proposed here by Shechaniah. Now, as the commentator Benson says, there was no doubt a provision made for the maintenance of the wives and children. They weren't going to send them out and let them starve. Of course not. Now, we look at verse 3, and we have a translation issue. Shechaniah is telling Ezra to put away all the wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord. Well, the NASB translation has my Lord as Lord in lowercase, L-O-R-D, which would mean that Shechaniah is calling Ezra my Lord. Kyle and Delitzsch object to that and say that that's not likely going to happen because of their relationship, but the NASB translates it that way. So does the Holman Christian Study Bible. I didn't investigate it any further, but there's an alternate translation. It could be according to the counsel of my Lord Yahweh. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. In other words, Shechaniah is claiming to speak for God here. At the end of verse 3, Shechaniah tells Ezra, let it be done according to the law. What does the it refer to? A couple of options according to the pulpit commentary. Option number 1, let the law be satisfied. Let it be done according to the law. In other words, the law says you weren't supposed to have pagan marriages to begin with, so let's get back to the way it should have been if we'd have been following the law from the get-go. Or it could be let it be done according to the law. The it might refer to let the divorces take place in the mode prescribed by law. The problem with that is there is no mode in the law to talk about how to put away pagan lives, at least not ostensibly. We'll talk about that a little bit further in just a minute. I don't think we'd really need to be that precise. The point is this whole procedure needs to be according to the law of Moses. Now, what does the law say about marrying non-Jews, pagans? Well, the key verse is Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 and 4. God tells Moses to tell the people, Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, because they will turn your sons away from me to worship other gods. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will swiftly destroy you. So there it is. So according to that law, they shouldn't have intermarried. But what makes this tricky is that they'd already done it, and now it's hard to unscramble eggs. And they've messed up, they violated the law, and now they've got to get back to a proper position, and it's harder to do that than if you'd have just obeyed the law to start with. Now, you could marry a non-Jew if the non-Jewish woman was a Jewish proselyte. And of course, that's why, as we'll see in verses 16 through 19, the Israelites had to appoint judges to examine these pagan wives to see if indeed they were proselytes or not. If they were proselytes, then they would not need to be divorced. Well, the law clearly says you're not supposed to marry a non-Jew, but the law doesn't say anything about divorcing someone who illegally married a non-Jew. So there's your problem. So we could say that Shechaniah's use of the term according to the law is a little bit loose. We need to do this. We need to do it. Carry out this divorce proceeding. We need to do it according to the law. Well, we can defend Ezra's action according to the law if we interpret the Mosaic law in one way. You recall Moses said that divorce was allowed for indecency in the wife, quote unquote indecency. Now, indecency, of course, would include bestiality and homosexuality and fornication, adultery, and all that. But indecency also could include idolatry, according to some scholars. In fact, by the time you get to the New Testament, indecency meant if the woman nagged too much or gossiped too much or burnt her toast when she was cooking breakfast. But back in Moses' time, according to some scholars I'm going to mention, indecency could include idolatry. Howard, Kidner, Stevenson, and Williamson say that. And so you could say, Shechaniah is saying, look, just according to the law, Moses said we could divorce wives for indecency, and idolatry is indecent, so that's done. The divorce of these wives would be done according to the law. Now that raises another legal question. What if the wife was not actually practicing idolatry? She was just a pagan from a pagan country, but she had gone along with the husband's Hebrew Yahweh worship. Maybe she's not an official proselyte yet, but she's not worshiping pagan gods, so she's kind of in legal limbo there. I guess that's why they had Jewish judges that had to spend 3 months looking into this thing. Now, this whole proceeding put these 110 Jewish men who had married pagan wives into a parlous position. The law said you couldn't be an Israelite if you married a foreign woman. I don't have a cite for that. One of my commentators said that, but it's obvious that being an Israelite, you don't marry foreign women. The law is very clear about that. So these 110 men had a choice. If they wanted to remain in the company of their fellow Israelites, they had to divorce their foreign wives, or they could leave Israel and go to the pagan country where their foreign wife lived. Well, that's probably not a good choice either if you were an Israelite man, but they were put between the rock and the hard place. What if they love this foreign wife? So they've got to say, do I follow her and go into pagan idolatry, or do I stay here where Yahweh is worshipped? Well, I would have stayed personally. I think that would be the smart decision, but it nonetheless is a difficult position, a difficult situation, especially if they really loved their wife. Now, one more point about this, and we'll discuss this later when we talk about the ethics of Ezra calling for a divorce. Ezra may have provided for divorce of the pagan wife as a merciful alternative to executing the pagan wives. This idea comes from a very interesting website I found called exegesisandtheology.com. That website quotes Deuteronomy 13:6-11, and I'll read that, but I'm going to edit it just to focus on the wife, and I'm going to change the masculine pronouns to feminine pronouns. This is how Deuteronomy 13:6-11 reads. If the wife you embrace secretly entices you, saying, let us go and worship other gods, you must not yield to her or listen to her. Show her no pity and do not spare her or shield her. Instead, you must kill her. Stone her to death for trying to turn you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. Well, that verse shows the attitude of Yahweh toward idolatry. It's very severe, as we see all through the Old Testament. So these pagan wives were subject to capital execution if they had enticed their husbands to idolatry. And I guarantee you, out of those 110, there were some that had done that. And so Ezra is actually being merciful to them by giving them a chance to go back to mommy, and go back to daddy, go back to their pagan gods. It seems to me that if I was or were a pagan wife and I was being brought before the judges to see if I was a proselyte or not, I would just become a proselyte if I wanted to renounce the pagan god and follow Yahweh and stay married to my husband. I suspect the Jewish judges that were set up for this procedure, I suspect that they would do that. Let them become proselytes if they wanted to. Going back to verse 4 now in Ezra 10, as Shechaniah is still speaking to Ezra, Shechaniah says, "Arise, for this matter is your responsibility, but we will be with you. Be courageous and act." In other words, I'm giving you moral support, Shechaniah says to Ezra, but you got to do something. You got to be courageous. Why courageous? Because it's a terrible thing to tell 110 men that their families are going to be busted up. And act. Do something. Well, Ezra did act, as we will see. But the question is, did he do so properly? The scholars divide on this point. Some say that Ezra was wrong, quoting that famous verse in Malachi 2:16. "For I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong, says the Lord of hosts. So take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously." So in other words, a critic could say to Ezra, "Look, two wrongs don't make a right. It was wrong that they married the pagan, and now you're committing a wrong in making them divorce. You add those two wrongs, do we end up with a righteous situation?" Other scholars, on the other hand, say that Ezra was right. Now, there's a couple of ways that you can justify what Ezra did. Let's take the first option first. The argument goes this way: marrying a foreign woman was tantamount to adultery or sexual sin, fornication, and one could divorce for that, for fornication. I mentioned earlier that Moses' divorce law, which I think is in Deuteronomy 24, if I remember correctly, it said the woman could be put away for indecency, and that included idolatry. Well, it also included fornication. You could divorce for fornication. Well, the problem with that is the text says that the foreign women, the Israelite men married foreigners, and marriage is a legal covenant relationship. It's much more than fornication. Let's read some verses here in Ezra that say very clearly that the issue was marriage, not fornication, with the pagan wives. Ezra 9:12, first part of the verse. "So do not give your daughters to their sons in marriage, or take their daughters for your sons." Ezra 9:14. "Should we break your commands again and intermarry with the people who commit these detestable practices? Wouldn't you become so angry with us that you would destroy us, leaving no survivors, if we intermarry with these people?" Well, we can push back against that, because the word for marriage here is not the normal term for marriage. This is according to exegesisandtheology.com. And in fact, the NASB margin has, instead of marriage, is given dwelling to, having, instead of having married the pagans, these Israelite men had, quote, given dwelling to. In other words, they let the women come live in their house, which could, of course, have been an arrangement of a man and his mistress, a fornicating arrangement, not a marriage arrangement. Well, that's a clever argument. However, most of the translations say that Ezra was complaining about marriage. And to be honest with you, I have a hard time believing that 110 Israelite men would take mistresses without marrying them. Now, they could have thought, well, the law's so strict about this, maybe we just better live in sin here rather than get married. I don't know. I guess it's possible, but I'm not really persuaded by that argument. So let's look at another way to justify Ezra in his command to divorce the pagan wives. The argument is very simple. To continue on with mixed marriages would have destroyed the nation. Of course, it would have. The idolatry would spread like leaven spreads through bread. It always does. It always did in the history of Israel. God was constantly having to come down on idolatry more than almost any other sin, because the idolatry led to all the other sins. Well, so we have two principles here that conflict. One, the sacredness of the marriage bond, and two, the sacredness of the marriage bond of Israel with Yahweh. Well, you got two important moral and ethical principles conflicting with each other. What do you do in that situation? Well, you always choose the choice that minimizes the damage. Now, that's standard ethics. I'll never forget, I took a biblical ethics course when I went to seminary, and it's probably the most important course I took because it happens all the time because we live in a sinful world that two moral principles come into conflict. The law of necessity is a tough law. I mean, just think of the New Testament example. The Jews, the Pharisees, this is not divine law, it's Pharisaical law, but they had a law that said that you don't pull an ox out of the ditch. And God had a law that said you don't work on Saturday, the Sabbath. And so then you had a conflict between two ethical principles, which is more important, the saving of the ox's life or the fact that somebody did a little bit of work getting the ox out of the ditch. Well, saving the ox's life was more important, as Jesus said. So I think I could defend Ezra in a court of law if somebody tried to accuse him. The text itself doesn't indicate whether Ezra was right or wrong, so you could take a third option. Well, he wasn't right. He shouldn't have done it, but I don't think so. I have a hard time with that one. Well, let me summarize four possible ways we might view Ezra's actions. Number one, Ezra was wrong. He shouldn't have caused these divorces to take place. Number two, Ezra was right because divorce for the indecency of idolatry was legal according to the Mosaic law. Option number three, Ezra was right because divorce for the indecency of fornication was legal, assuming the word for marriage means fornication and not marriage. Option number four, Ezra was right because he chose a greater good than that overcame the evil of breaking the bond of marriage. I report, you decide. We go to Ezra 10, verses 5 through 8. Then Ezra rose and made the leading priest, the Levites, and all Israel take oath that they would do according to this proposal, Shechaniah's proposal, which was that they should make a covenant with God and kick all the foreign wives out of the houses of the sinning Israelites. So they took the oath, the leading priest and Levites and all Israel, everybody took the oath to do this. Verse 6, then Ezra rose from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib. Although he went there, he did not eat bread nor drink water, for he was mourning over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. He's still pretty shook up. That shows how sensitive he was about the law of God. Would that there would be people in the Church of Christ today who would be a little bit more sensitive about the holiness of God. Now, Ezra, as he awaits for the execution of the divorces, he goes to a chamber of the son of the high priest, because Eliashib is the high priest. Jehohanan is Eliashib's son, and they probably lived in one of those rooms that were three stories high all around the outside walls of Solomon's temple. Well, except that Solomon's temple was not in existence then. It was a smaller temple. So my question is, were there the same sort of rooms around the edge of the temple that were there during Solomon's time? I doubt it. But that is an unnecessary rabbit trail. Elisha is in Jehohanan's room. He's still not eating, and he's still not drinking. He's really upset. How do we know that Elisha was the high priest, the father of the man whose room Ezra was in? Well, we read in Nehemiah 3:1, Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests began rebuilding the sheep gate. They dedicated it and installed its doors. So Eliashib was the high priest in Nehemiah's time. He became 14 years after Ezra, so we assume this is the same Eliashib the high priest. Verse 7 says, they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem. The they is probably referring to the leading priest and the leading priest, which are mentioned in verse 5. They made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the exiles that they should assemble at Jerusalem, and that whoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the leaders and the elders, all his possessions should be forfeited, and he himself excluded from the assembly of the exiles. Now, how did Ezra have the right to command everybody to show up within 3 days or else lose your property? That's serious business. Well, actually, the edict that Ezra had from Artaxerxes I gave Ezra this power, at least indirectly. We read this in Ezra 7:26. This is the decree that Ezra had given to, that Artaxerxes had given to Ezra. Anyone who does not keep the law of your God and the law of the king, let a fair judgment be executed against him, whether death, banishment, confiscation of property, or imprisonment. Artaxerxes said, somebody doesn't keep the law of your God, well, marrying pagan women was not keeping the law of your God. So Ezra had every right to confiscate their property if they did not obey what he said. I said that was at least indirectly that Artaxerxes had given Ezra that power. I would say that's too soft. Ezra had the power. It's clear from the decree. He had the power to confiscate property upon disobedience to his commands when the law of God was violated. We go now to Ezra 10, verses 9 through 11. So all the men of Judah and Benjamin, remember those are the two southern tribes, that's all that's left, assembled at Jerusalem within the 3 days. It was the ninth month on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You have been unfaithful and have married foreign wives according to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do his will, and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." This is 3 days later. Ezra had not been eating. I wonder if he went 3 days with no food and water. It doesn't say, but he was fasting before his difficult job here. It was on the ninth month that they assembled in the heavy rain. The ninth month is Kislev in November, December. That's the rainy season. This is still the first year of Ezra's return, who came back in 458. Remember, he left, I think, on the first of Nisan, first of the month. He arrives in the fifth month of Ab, so it took him 4+ months to get there. I forgot the days, but this is still the same month. So this is how he's spending the same year, I'm sorry. So this is how he's spending his first year in Judah. It was not very pleasant. So it's Kislev 20 that all the people are sitting in the open square. I'm assuming it's at the end of the 3 days to give the Israelites the allotted 3 days to get there. Now these people sitting in the open square, you know they must have been stressed. They're in the rain. It's cold. Some of them are about to lose their families. And worse than all that, they are afraid of God's wrath because of what they had done. So this is a real come to Jesus meeting. Now this open square where they met, that could hold thousands of people. That's the outer court, I think, of the temple. If it was like Solomon's temple, the inner court was the court of the priest and the court of man. Then you go down the steps and you're into the what later became the court of the Gentiles, but now it's just an open square. So all the people could assemble there in that plaza. It says they were trembling in verse 9. Well, it was December. They were cold and wet, and they were probably scared too. In fact, it says they were trembling because of this matter, because they had married foreign wives, and Ezra was about to lower the boom on them. They were trembling because of that, and also because of the heavy rain. And so Ezra gives them the speech. You've been unfaithful. Confess before God. Do his will. Separate yourselves from these wives. And in doing so, you separate yourselves from the peoples of the land. Do your duty, Israelites. We go now to verses 12 through 15 of Ezra 10. Then all the assembly answered and said with a loud voice, "That's right, as you have said, so it is our duty to do. But there are many people. It is the rainy season, and we are not able to stand in the open. Nor can the task be done in 1 or 2 days, for we have transgressed greatly in this matter. Let our leaders represent the whole assembly, and let all those in our cities who have married foreign wives come at appointed times, together with the elders and judges of each city, until the fierce anger of our God on account of this matter is turned away from us. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Jaaziah, the son of Tikvah, oppose this, with Meshulam and Shabbatai, the Levite, supporting them." Now the people standing there shivering and trembling tell Ezra that, hey, this job can't be done in 1 or 2 days. In fact, it took 3 months, as we'll see when we get to verses 16 and 17. So they wanted to set up a schedule at appointed times in verse 14. They wanted to set up people, elders and judges, set up a legal procedure, a process to judge whether someone was guilty of marrying a foreign wife or not. Now this was a good suggestion because each offender would have an appointment with a local judge, and the local judge would know the parties involved. They would know whether the wives were worshipers of God or whether they were worshiping pagan gods. And if they were worshiping God, were they a legal proselyte yet? Would they become a proselyte? I'm sure the judges would have to figure all that out. Now, in verse 15, it sounds like the minutes of a modern business meeting or a political meeting. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Jaaziah, the son of Tikvah, opposed this, opposed setting up the elders and judges in the local areas to judge the individual Israelites, they opposed it. We don't know why. It doesn't say. We can speculate. Maybe they wanted to take care of the situation right then and there. Maybe they were zealots and said, yes, Ezra, you're right. 110 men stand up and publicly denounce your wives and send them packing to mama. Well, if that's silly, that's in the rain in one day, right on the spot, that's not going to happen. More probably is the reason they opposed is that they wanted to not force the foreign wives to be divorced. They wanted to keep those foreign wives. We can speculate. But Meshulam and Shabbethai the Levite supported Jonathan the son of Asahel and Jaaziah the son of Tikvah. So we got four people who are not going along with Ezra's idea here. We know that Meshulam is listed by name as one that was guilty of having a foreign wife. Ezra 10 verse 29 later in this chapter. Bani's descendants, Meshulam, ... Meshulam's listed. The other three are not. So we can understand why Meshulam wouldn't want to go along with what Ezra was saying. We go down to Ezra 10 verses 16 and 17. But the exiles did so. Did what? They scattered to their localities to appear before their elders and judges, as was suggested by the people to Ezra in verse 14. And Ezra the priest selected men who were heads of fathers' households for each of their fathers' households, all of them by name. So they convened on the first day of the 10th month to investigate the matter. And they finished investigating all the men who had married foreign wives by the first of the first month. So Ezra, being the judicial reformer that he was and the lawyer that he was, he sets up a judicial procedure to investigate the matter. So he gets the judges all set up, and they convene on the first day of the 10th month. That's 11 days after this rainy convocation. Remember, that meeting in the courtyard plaza was on the 20th day of the 9th month. This is the first day of the 10th month. So 20 plus 10 gets you to 30, 9th month, 30th day, and then one more day will give you the first day on the 10th month. So it's 11 days. And, of course, the first month is Nisan. We're still in the year. Well, we're still, that's the new year now, so we're not in 458 anymore, we're in 457. So it took 3 months, as we said earlier, to finish this job of appointing the judges. Now, Ezra 10, 18 through 44, list all of the sinning Hebrews who married the pagan wives, and I am not about to read all of them. I'll just pick out a few things to point out to you. In verse 18, we read this, and among the sons of the priest who had married foreign wives were found of the sons of Jeshua the son of Jozadak. Now, Jeshua the son of Jozadak ought to ring a bell in your memory because he was the high priest in the times of Jerubbaal. There were two leaders in Israel in 538 when the Israelites under Jerubbaal had left because of Cyrus's decree, left Babylon and gone into Judah. One was Jerubbaal, the political leader, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, was the religious leader. In fact, he was the high priest. And so sons of this Jeshua, this is 80 years later, sons can mean descendants, of course. You got people, they had a good lineage, they came from good stock, but they weren't quite as holy as Jeshua, the high priest, was. Now, how many priests and Levites were involved in this sin? Well, there were 17 priests who had a pagan wife, and there were 10 Levites. So 27 out of the 110 were priests and Levites, leaders of the people. Bad business. In verse 19, we see a ram is offered. Each individual offered a ram of the flock. That's according to the Levitical law. For trespass offerings, or guilt offerings, as they're sometimes called. That's in Leviticus 5, verses 14 through 15. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, if someone offends by sinning unintentionally in regard to any of the Lord's holy things, he must bring his restitution offering to the Lord, an unblemished ram from the flock, as a restitution offering. Now, I will say this about restitution offerings, or trespass offerings, or guilt offerings. Everybody says it's for unintentional sins. In fact, it says right here, Leviticus 5:15, if anyone offends by sinning unintentionally with regard to any of the Lord's holy things. Well, that means if you accidentally make yourself unclean by touching a vessel in the temple that's been consecrated for use in the sacrificial system, well, then you offer a trespass offering. But that does not mean that every single sin that requires a trespass offering was unintentional. I don't have the site in front of me, but I remember reading through Leviticus and found that restitution offerings were to be made when someone kept bailed property and negligently screwed it up, or actually stole it. Bailed property is property that somebody keeps for somebody else, and then they refuse to give it back. That's not unintentional. That's intentional, and yet the law required a trespass offering. So that's another myth that's out there. Guilt offerings are only for unintentional sins. And here, if you think about it, how is this unintentional? You married a pagan wife. Did you not know that you were violating the law when you did that? If you were a priest and a Levite, somehow I have a hard time as categorizing that as an unintentional sin. At any rate, the ram was offered. Now, if you get down to verse 25, we see a Parash is mentioned, of the sons of Parash, and a bunch of names are mentioned. Well, those family names correspond closely to Zerubbabel's returnees, exiles that came back 80 years earlier in 538, which I suppose is not surprising. Not surprising that the families would have dispersed too much after only 80 years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished not only Ezra chapter 10, but the entire book of Ezra. The temple has been rebuilt. The people have been reformed, their marriages. The law has been reformed. A judicial system of some sort has been established. Now we're going to see about the walls of the city, because 14 years later, Nehemiah is going to need to show up to repair those walls, and we'll see that as we take up Nehemiah in the next book. So I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.